And for those of you that are new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial for how to use this podcast. When you hear the bell ding, that means that you should look on your device to see what paper we're referencing to back up what we're saying. But if you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether or not you want to take it or leave it.
. 2016 is coming to a close, a year that makes you question all kinds of things, even your own ability to make a decision. And last month, we discussed the use of MRI in the ED, and this led to an even deeper discussion on how we practice in the emergency department. We're trained to find any dangerous condition that could be lurking in an unsuspecting patient, but when can you say you've really looked hard enough? Who can be reassured and sent home with no more than a good history and physical exam? And who needs advanced imaging, extra testing, and maybe even an overnight observation because you just can't shake the notion that they may not be okay on their own? With four different practice styles, Jared, Brian, Chris, and I are going to discuss how emergency physicians think and how we personally deal with diagnostic uncertainty.
So already there are people listening to this that are saying, why are we even talking about this? Because I don't have MRI where I'm at, and it's a six-hour trip by Burro to get my patient to the MRI scanner. The reason we're talking about this is because our residents are learning this. They're not listening. They've already clicked it off. They heard boy band. Just shut it off. So it's because our residents are being trained this. You know, when our residents see on the in-service exam a female comes in with right lower quadrant pain, they're ordering the MRI. That's not the right answer.
Right.
But it is the right answer here, right? Yeah. So the approach, you have to learn what you do in an all-time setting. This is similar to our discussion on ultrasound. It's cutting-edge stuff. Ordering MRI for all this stuff is not applicable in the majority of emergency departments, but it might be.
It's their future, though.
Yeah. I mean, remember when we were residents, MRI was like grandma's sitting furniture. You couldn't go in that room. The neurosurgeons would get all upset because they had to come down to a consult to get an MRI on something,
and we had to page the tech. They had to come in from home.
Exactly. But if it's, we've argued this before. My opinion is, if it is the imaging modality that you need, and it is inconveniently long or expensive or logistically challenging to get that study, then figure out how to solve those problems, not just not order the test.
Yeah, I mean, I think arguing whether this is MRI is useful to other people and if they don't have a machine, I think this is a testing in general, right? To me, MRI is a test. There will be a new technology that comes out beyond MRI, and this will apply to that one. This applies to a procalcitonin. Every test that we get that's new, that is trying to help us with our diagnostic uncertainty, is a new thing like MRI is, just like CT scan, just like ultrasound, just like point-of-care ultrasound. All these add to what we can or should do in the emergency room trying to answer a question of when the patient presents, and the patients don't present with, I have ovarian torsion, they present with abdominal pain or pelvic pain, and you're trying to sort through the myriad of diagnoses and narrow it down with the best tests available, knowing that no test other than an OR cystoscope, you know, in those cases, is going to be the best test of choice. And it's hard, right? How do you say, you know, even if it is the future of what it is, it will be the future's past eventually. So this is just another test. And what are we gaining? What are we not gaining? I agree. I don't think you should order things like in a stepwise manner all the time to when there is a better test to order. I think what you have to do is my pretest probability enough that I need to order a test because I can't call the consultant to do something because I don't have enough diagnostic certainty, but it's not low enough pretest probability where I can say, you know what, this patient can go home, I can give them return precautions and see them the next day. So it's really trying to, you know, where is that gauge of whether I need to order a test to help me or not? And that's what we're really talking about with MRI. We're just using it as the vehicle right now, but it could be anything. It could be whatever we want to call it.
There's an article that Aaron was kind enough to send out to us in Academic Emergency Medicine, April 2015, and that's actually the point they made. We believe that an unnecessary test is one that, regardless of what it does or does not find, cannot be expected to change the pretest probability of diseases in a clinically meaningful way. I think that was succinctly put, and I agree. And when we look at ordering any test, we have to have at least some basic understanding of the probability of the disease that we're looking for, and then the test characteristics of the diagnostic that we're ordering.
We have a bit of a bad habit of being if-then type operators, you know, instead of Bayesian people who say, oh, I think there's a reasonable enough risk, I need to get this test, and then my post-test probability is going to be X. It's, I have a patient with chest pain, the labs didn't give me my diagnosis, therefore I need to get something else. That didn't give me my diagnosis, therefore I need to get something else. Right? We are a specialty that is at risk, if not already there, of falling into that trap. And I think that's where you see things like, get the ultrasound, that didn't help, get the CT, that didn't help, get the MRI, which brings us to the point that you just brought up.
I consider myself a smooth operator.
He's a smooth operator.
I think the trap that you get into is patient has abdominal pain, order the MRI. Patient has a headache, order the MRI. Patient hit their head, order the MRI. Patient has back pain, order the MRI. Because it does give you the answers for the dangerous stuff that you want to rule out. Great. But it also tells you incidentalomas that you didn't need to know about. By the way, you have a bunch of granulomas in your lung, and I don't know what that means, and you got a lymph node that was kind of big, and that mole doesn't look right. And the second thing is you can't give that technology and that degree of resources to every single patient without first risk stratifying them for, do you really have an epidural abscess? One of the studies that we brought up as well was that when we do an MRI looking for an epidural abscess, we don't find much at all. Our accuracy is terrible in the ED. Now, I don't want to miss that. So the few that I found, and granted, there's probably dozens I didn't find, but the few that I found were like, oh, wow, you're an ABEM boards question. You have fever, you've got a drug needle hanging out of your arm, and you've got back pain, and you can't pee. Like, oh, you probably need an MRI. And one of the residents I was working with looked at me like I was a genius that I found it. I was like, no, like that's really straightforward. You'll remember this one forever. I am not that smart at all to be able to pick that one up. But the ones that we go, well, maybe, you know, they've got fever and they said their back's hurt for the last 7 years. Maybe we should just get the MRI. I worry about that kind of over-testing for a low prevalent disease. You got to pick it up when they have a high risk for having the disease to begin with. So if you just order it because, well, they got belly pain, maybe they got something bad, you're going to find a whole lot of nothing or a whole lot of, I don't know what to do with this.
I'll be perfectly honest. My judgment is clouded for two reasons. The first is you may not have seen many of these subtle ones individually in your practice, but they all filter through to the ICU.
Mm-hmm.
And so my pretest probability is skewed by that. Therefore, my judgment is clouded.
That's why you haven't seen 100 patients.
Yeah. The second reason why my judgment is clouded is of the four of us, I'm the one that's been hauled in front of the state medical board for not getting an MRI on a diabetic foot ulcer that did not appear infected by x-ray, labs, physical exam. And it went to my peer, and the peer said, oh, you should have got an MRI.
Well, I think if a peer is saying that you have to have an MRI for a diabetic foot ulcer, they're skewed themselves, because that's irrational thought. I mean, that's, and it is, but we all have our bias. I mean, that's really what you're saying. You're biased because you are the end of the funnel, where we're the opening of the funnel. And so there's two different things, right? Every neurosurgeon believes subarachnoid hemorrhage is easy to pick up because they only see the subarachnoid hemorrhage, they don't see the headaches. And so it's true. So it's a different perspective, and I agree. And I think having that, it's hard to, you know, you just have to know where people are coming from and with these tests and say, well, just because you're telling me something, but you only see the positive results of the test, where I see every test. And like Aaron's saying, you can't just abdominal pain MRI everybody, because I would argue half of all abdominal pain we see is bull. I don't know if I can say, but I said it twice now.
Just keep saying it. I'll keep bleeping it.
But it's true. I mean, that's why I give them Haldol. They're crazy. You do some lab tests to say that they have nothing, to say that you've done something, but you send those patients home. And you know the ones that have that. Now, if we MRI'd all those, oh my gosh, that would be a definite, you know, Alice in Wonderland down the rabbit hole. But I agree. There's certain ones that you need to order the best test right away. If you're worried about an epidural compression disease, you need to go after that. But at the same time, most back pain doesn't have it. So it's that balance, right? It's when do you pull the trigger on it, like with any of these tests. When do you pull that trigger? And that's something that I think over time, you get a perspective. Yeah, you'll miss some. Yeah, you won't. But you can't do it all the time, and you can't do it none of the time. You have to find that balance for you.
Did you order the x-ray, and then the ultrasound, and then the CT, and then the MRI, because you're not comfortable not having an answer? Because in the ED, we don't give out answers. We're not diagnosticians.
No, we cross things off the list.
Mm-hmm. We rule out bad things.
And Brian sent out a very, I think, important email a few weeks ago commenting on how he's afraid that we're training our young physicians to rely so heavily on diagnostics that they're not willing to just rely on their own gestalt or clinical acumen, or be confident in their physical exam, confident in their history taking and in their diagnosis, that they have to have a definitive test. And where does that apprehension come from? Is it from medical legal? I think there's the specter of medical legal pushback is maybe larger than the reality of it. And you know, that I think that needs to be addressed. And the last thing I want to be blamed of or charged with is teaching our residents to not trust themselves, so that they just have to be, you know, so algorithmic that they have to have an MR on certain belly pain, for example.
Before Brian weighs in, I want to say I talked with one of our ped surgeons earlier who said, you guys order so much imaging in the emergency department. She said, I've been doing this for a long time, and you don't need imaging to pick up the kinds of things you're calling me about. And, to be fair, I haven't done this for as long as you have. And also, to be fair, with a lot of our consultations, the residents who are responding want to get an answer before they come to their attending. And the attendings who may have been doing it for a long time, they recognize that's a small bowel obstruction clinically that needs to go to the OR. There's no doubt about it.
And I haven't had success saying, I think this is a small bowel. I think this is a torsion. You need to take it. No, we need the imaging. Go ahead. I'll even put in the admin orders, but go ahead and order the test. Well, you know, and it's so easy for us to say, well, I've done my best. I told them I thought it was, but in the back of our heads, we're kind of reassured also that we're getting a definitive test. And so it's just so easy for us to just say, well, you know, I tried, but the consultant wants this test. Let's go ahead and get it. It makes me feel better. It's like a security blanket.
Do you think that we have institutionalized this discomfort with uncertainty with the physician and triage stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think it may be reinforced, as Chris was saying, but I think this started before. Why did RME come out is because we order basic labs. And whenever I hear basic labs, I kind of cringe in my head, like, oh, it's basic. I guess everyone's supposed to get this. I mean, it's irrelevant. That's stupid. The CBC is useless. We get it maybe for a surgeon, but it rarely diagnoses things that we want it to. A chemistry is reasonable. We don't order just a basic chemistry. We order a comprehensive medical metabolic panel, because this person who's presenting with dehydration, we're obviously worried about their LFTs. No, we're not worried about their LFTs. You wanted to see a potassium and a creatinine and make sure they're having good urine output. Well, how do you ask about urine output? You ask the question, are you peeing? What does it look like? Oh, you're peeing. Okay, good. But, you know, so we're doing these diagnostic tests, and so RME, I think, is coming as a byproduct of that. But why are we doing it? Well, because we're trying to move patients through. So I think the physician in triage is really trying to order things that are going to be ordered anyway sooner and making sure the patient gets the IV because it is a delay.
But that's the intent. But what you end up seeing is that I think our residents are saying, well, okay, this is the standard order that I get on everybody. Also, the RME doc is trying to guess what they're going to do in the back. And if you're going to err, you better err on the side of over-testing, because otherwise you're not improving efficiency. If you miss, you know, if the person in back wanted LFTs and you ordered a BMP, that person's going to have to order the LFTs, and that negates
you might as well not even been there.
You might have been not even been there.
Well, and we can argue whether we should even be there in the first place, but that's a whole other conversation.
Well, now the residents are seeing the patient, and they've got it's all got a bow on it, right?
Right. And is that's an education?
I'm getting labs in my HPI presentation, but that's a different beast, because it's definitely unique to our population here at an academic center, but it is a very
but it speaks to that algorithmic approach to emergency medicine that I think MRI is now starting to fall into. Someone comes in with right lower quadrant pain and they're under a certain age, that equals MRI. A female comes in with pelvic pain, that equals an MRI.
When I was a resident, and I'm sorry for derailing, because I want to hear your take on uncertainty too, but when I was a resident, one of our now partners told me that I was on this kick, I was going to save money, right? So I wasn't going to order labs and this, that, and the other. And the attending says, nobody's going to send you a thank you card for saving them $60 by not ordering the CBC, but they're definitely going to send you a complaint letter when you miss something for not getting it.
Well, I think the flip side going with the MRI to that, too, is I've just spent 10 hours in the ER. I've had 15 different lab tests, an MRI, a CT, an ultrasound, and no one knows what's going on with me. And now I'm pissed because you spend a bunch of money, you didn't figure it out, doctor, and here's my pissed letter. So it goes both ways. You know, that's right. Absolutely. How do we satisfy the patient in general? And I think Aaron does a good job with this. What?
It's a lot of
morphine. I got lots of ways to satisfy patients. But I think Aaron does a good job and has mentioned this before. I think what patients really want is reassurance. They want to understand what you think is going on with them. And if that means holding their hands, they want the show, right? They want you to look in their ears, you know, kick the tires of the car, I think we said, you know, open the mouth, palpate, put your hands on them, lay some hands, sit down, talk to them, hold grandma's hand. And you can do that for 5 or 10 minutes. And they're like, yeah, okay, I think I feel better, doc. I'm ready to go. As opposed to doing the full shabam. Now, sometimes you have to do it, but I think you've mentioned that multiple times. I mean, how do you tell a distressed mother that her kid is coming in and it's a virus? And we say it's just a virus. We shouldn't say it. Viruses suck. You know, you have a really bad condition. These things last 10 to 14 days. And I do the same thing. This is horrible. Like, gosh, your child's miserable. You're miserable. You're not sleeping, are you? And so I think it's... I lost where I was going.
The greatest encounter I had with regard to this was a lady who came in. I was working one of the 5 to 2 shifts, and it's probably 1:30 in the morning. I hadn't slept the night before, and I'm just tired. And this lady's got all these complaints, and she's just talking and talking, and I'm kind of staring at her. But I'll be honest, I had kind of zoned out. I was so tired. And then I clued back in just in time to hear her say, you know, doc, I think this is actually just all in my head. I'm just so stressed out, and I think I just really needed someone to listen to me. No one's ever taken the time to really just listen to me before. It means so much to me. I think I feel better. I'd like to go home now. I was like, yes, don't move. Don't change your mind. Don't move. Because what is somebody going to get with a fatigue, weakness, dizzy kind of? They're going to get all kinds of stuff.
But what would have happened if she came in and you got the initial story and you thought, yeah, it's all in your head. You just need to talk to somebody, go home. Had you presented that to the patient, what would have happened?
There's nothing wrong. You have nothing wrong with you.
Well, you do. Well, it's in your head, though. It's not
like
a fix.
Why do I feel terrible?
So let me give you a case that I had last night. I think it fits perfectly and fits into what Brian was talking about, uncertainties. So the story was, though, that was just working out at a gym, was doing those plyometrics, jumping up on a truck tire, actually. Slipped out from underneath her, fell back, hit her head. Questionable LOC, probably no LOC. Perseverating for a while on scene. By the time she got to us, though, maybe just feeling a little bit off, and a headache. And that was it. And so the resident was talking to me, and, you know, no neck pain. Everything else was checking out. Neurologically, absolutely fine, and really returned back to normal. And due to the wait in the waiting room, by the time I actually got to see her, it had been about 4 hours since her fall. And so at that point, we're deciding on a CT or not. And I allowed myself to just be talked into perseveration for even a little bit equals CT, which I wouldn't always do, by the way. And we ended up just getting a CT. Well, what does the CT show? It shows this mass, a small little mass, towards the base of the skull, which they said could be concerning for a metastasis, given the patient's history of cancer. I said, well, I didn't know the patient had a history of cancer. So I go through the chart, and she's had an abnormal colposcopy in the past. Not truly cancer, though. I said, well, I don't know. So I went and talked to the patient about an outpatient MRI, and the conversation went something like, you know, we typically wouldn't do these emergently. It is very important you get this followed up. Here's referral. Can you make that happen? She was kind of reticent to leave, and then said okay. And then we handed her discharge papers. She said, I don't think I can last for a week or two without knowing if this is cancer or not. Can you do something about that? So what do? I ordered the MRI because I'm trying to treat the patient like I would my own mother, you know? And that is fraught with emotional peril if you ever trained it, but I'm trying to treat it like I would treat Brian's mother, okay? So, you know, I want to say that.
I love my mom.
And so we ordered this test, and I get the MR back hours later, and it's just a hypertrophied, like the longest colli muscle of the neck. That's it. Nothing else. So I would come and say, oh, this is good news, very good news. And then, you know, initially, yes, there's some relief there, but I think maybe today or tomorrow she's going to realize how much this has just cost her, all because of a misread by a radiology resident and an aggressive emergency workup that ended up costing double the amount on that MR than it would have outpatient. And I'm still now wondering really what the right thing to do is. I'm wondering if actually the right thing would have been to order no imaging up front, watch her and say, yep, you got a concussion. Here's return precautions. I really hope you don't have a head bleed. So, did I do wrong?
No. You can't speculate on how she's going to feel about it today or tomorrow.
It's hard to say whether your practice is wrong based on what you saw at that time and made a decision. I think when people question each other's decision with what they see, that's fraught with error.
And I'm fine with being wrong on that. I mean, I don't know what the right answer. The residents are looking to me saying, does this even meet criteria? And I said, no. According to our last instructions from our department administration, this does not meet criteria for an emergency MRI.
Could you go home and
no,
have
absolutely
that in the
not.
Back of your mind for the
and,
next
and
two
the
weeks?
Whole time I'm thinking, if that were me sitting there, they probably would have started with an MRI, right?
So let's say that this, we make the big bucks because we go into every room with the knowledge, not the fear of, but the knowledge that I may have to stand before somebody and justify what I did, even if it's just myself in the mirror tomorrow. I may have to stand up before a judge or this patient's family or a complaint letter or whatever and explain why I did or didn't. I may have to stand up before my own peers or the hospital review committee or my medical director and explain why I did or didn't. So it's a tough job. There's no easy way to figure this out, and I think everybody deals with it a bit differently. But I feel in the same way. I had a similar exam that was actually signed out to me, and it was concerning for possible cancer. Recommend MRI. I was like, I just don't think in this day and age that we can send people home and say it could be cancer. Follow up with your PCP for an MRI in 2 weeks. I still feel very, very conflicted about doing that. I think it's wrong.
I think that's a charged diagnosis too. I mean, it's different than other diagnosis. Cancer has, I mean, the that when you say cancer to someone, they don't think about it. You can't undo it.
Yeah, you might have cancer. Go see your PCP.
Right, you can't undo that word. So I think that's
a boy band here.
Right, mm-hmm. I think that's a totally different question. You know, so if there's a concern on whether it's cancer or not, as opposed to I got the CT on the. I mean, my cases are usually the CT of the belly shows colon cancer. Now I got to go tell the patient. Mm-hmm. The CT shows ovarian cancer. I got to go. You have Mets in your liver on the CT. That's usually as a, and in those patients I don't get an MRI right, because right. You know, it looks like cancer, it talks like cancer. You have cancer, let's go with that and go from there.
Can I wax way philosophic for a second?
You've already waxed. You've waxed this off the road.
I want to hear it.
All right, go for it.
Do you know the train car dilemma? Train car dilemma is, I think I've told you this before. There's a train car coming down the track, okay? And there's a fork, a split in the track. And on track A, if you do nothing, it's going to go straight, okay? And on that track is a few people laying there. And if you do nothing, train's going to run over those people, okay? They're all going to die. You could flip the switch and make that train go to the other track, and on the other track is one person, and that person's going to die, but the five people laying on track A are going to live. What do you do? Do you pull a switch? Do you not pull a switch? The answer to that depends on if you're a utilitarian who would say you do the most good for the most people, in which case you pull that switch, you kill that person, and three people live. Or if you're a deontologist that would say, you're not going to kill those three people, the train's going to kill those three people, the only choice you can make is, do I kill this one person or not? So you do the best you can for the decisions that you can control, okay? I kind of apply this to what we do for a job, right? The utilitarians would say, don't get that MRI, send them home to their PCP, don't do these other things because we have a lobby full of people. We're trying to do the most good for the most people. The deontologist would say, you know what, I'm going to send this lady home. I'm going to say the word cancer to her. I'm going to send her home. She's going to perseverate over it. She's not going to hear anything else I say other than the fact that you may have cancer. So the right thing to do is to get the MRI, knowing full well that people are going to have to wait in the lobby. And you know what? One of them may be sick, but I can't do anything about that. What I can do is the best for my patient right here. I'm more a deontologist than a utilitarian, but I think as a specialty, we're more utilitarian than deontologists.
I would flip the switch. I'd kill the one over the five.
Well, that's why you and I are totally different.
I know.
You're more utilitarian.
But see, to me, it's people are going to die either way. I have to minimize it. I have the option to make it. So me not making a decision, I think, is almost as bad as making the decision. I have to live with the decision either way. Mm-hmm. The non-decision or the decision, I still have to live
with. There's nothing wrong with either decision.
Right. I'm just saying that would be what I would do. I think, you know, to quickly answer Chris's question, you know, what would you do in these patients? I think head trauma in general is the way I approach it is, are you as a patient going to benefit from a neurosurgeon cutting in your brain? And that's how I approach every patient with head trauma, because that is really the question I want to know. So if I'm going to image you, and I explain this to patients, I think neurologically you look normal. You are reading the clock. You are texting on your phone. You're talking to me normal. You are walking normally right now. I can do a CT scan. But if I do that CT scan and we find a little bit of blood, you may have to stay in the hospital for 2 days. Or if I find an epidural hematoma, you may have to stay in there. But right now, a neurosurgeon can't improve you neurologically any better. Do you understand that? And most of them do, like, oh yeah, I'm fine. As opposed to someone who has deficits and is not their normal neurologic self, I think a CT scan is imaging is appropriate at that time. So I explain that to patients and say, look, if someone cuts on your brain and you're normal, you're not going to be normal again. That's not how brain surgery works. But it does work is if you're abnormal, we can get you more normal. And they get that concept really well. I think with head injuries and on when you don't image is because, you know, you have symptoms, right? And we have PCARN things, vomiting. You know, oh, I had a second vomiting episode. If you hit your head, you're nauseous and going to vomit. That is a given. Mm-hmm. Like, that is what happens when you hit your head, whether it's a mild concussion. And we concuss ourselves all the time. Whether we truly diagnose it as a concussion or not depends on how many concussions you've had in the past or how many times your brain has been injured and how well it is to respond. But people will perseverate. People will have... vomiting, you know, but if they're back to a normal status, I watch them and give them precautions, but I don't usually image them. The exceptions would be people say, I've just had brain surgery and I have a flap. Okay, that's a reason I think to image them. Or if this lady says, yeah, I'm doing these calisthenic stuff and I'm jumping up on the tire, but oh yeah, I'm on Plavix, I would probably image them. So if they're on a blood thinner or put them at higher risk, I would probably image those. Not that imaging, I think, is you're wrong and you should be, you know, put out in the shame factory, Chris. I think it's just a different perspective on, you know, trying to answer how do you approach or how do you deal with diagnostic uncertainty. I try to think of the follow-on steps that are going to, if I look for something and find it, what will happen progressively down the road? The same approach I think I take to PE. Right? I think you're a young, healthy person. You have normal-looking vitals. You had a little twinge of chest pain. Could I order a D-dimer that could lead me to a CT angio? And if that shows a subsegmental PE, am I now putting you on an anticoagulant that's going to be there for 3 to 6 months? That's a real decision. So do I think she needs an anticoagulant? No. I think I can have a discussion with her and have that conversation. Well, let's watch you. You know, you look good now. I think you can go home. So, and these are like, wow, Brian, that's really risk adverse. But most people with PEs, you know, what we really care about is those who are going to be sick and come see Jared. That's the PE I worry about. Because even I think Peter Rosen, you guys were talking about at one point, had a clot and it went away and no one can find it and did a bunch of imaging. So people have clots and it comes and goes all the time. What you care about is a clot that comes on and disturbs their heart, disturbs their hemodynamics, and stresses them to the point that if you're not intervening, they're going to get worse and eventually die.
Do you think that I don't disagree with you one bit. I think in general you're probably more okay with uncertainty than many of us and many patients. But do you think that graphs like the one that were handed out at faculty meeting, the implication there being that we should all practice more like you, or is it just, you know, here's a scatter plot of people's practice styles? Are we professionals or are we drones?
I think everybody should practice like
that. That's always bothered me when literature talks about variation in practice that you know, exceeds a standard of deviation, for example, and that's always viewed as bad. To me, I view that as, you know, we've got a lot of different people practicing, you know, almost like each one's an individual lab of practice style, and especially in an educational environment, I think that's very important that the residents, you know, see that variation in practice. They get to pick what they like and shun what they don't. So I do not want us to all practice, you know, normatively.
I think they're good if used the right way. So I think variation in practice amongst emergency physicians is wide. Is that good on certain topics? No. So an example would be, you could look at groups, and they've looked at this in the literature, CT scans for syncope range from 5% to 95% of patients presenting with syncope get CT scans. Now, we know in the literature that CT scan for syncope is a very low yield test. So in those patients, in that case, I think having a representation and knowing that, hey, I'm way outside the standard deviation, maybe we can, as a group, look at our numbers and talk about this. Why are we ordering this many CT scans? Is everyone you have just on blood thinners and they're falling and hitting their head and that's why you're doing it? Or this person's not? But that's probably not the case, because over time the average will take you back to, no, they just had syncope. But how can we narrow our variation? And so I think that's what these things should be looked at, is, okay, what is our, you know, when you bell curve something, you could be a variation of 1% to 2% and still bell curve it and show standard deviations. Correct. What you want it to be is maybe our variation in practice is 5% to 20%. That's a reasonable number. But when you start to go like 5.95 or from, you know, 1% to 70%, that's a broad variation. Maybe the 1% is under underordering a test, and the 70%, maybe we can, hey, why are we doing this? And that's
especially
where you want
to use. For situations where there's good data, for example,
correct.
CCT and syncope. The quandary I've been having more recently with kind of the falling out of the ABCD2 score, getting back to MRIs with TIAs. So back in the day, I used to use ABCD2 score to decide if I thought this patient should be admitted or not. If they needed to be admitted, I would consult neurology, get a CT, and try to admit them pre-MRI, let them do it inpatient. But once I started relying more heavily on the ABCD2 score, hoping that that was a clinical tool I could use to discharge patients potentially, I would get the MRI. I'd skip the CT because why repeat two diagnostic tests on the same part of the body? I didn't think they were bleeding out. So I would get an MRI only, not consult neurology, by the way, because they always gummed up the works. And then based on that score, discharge somebody home, letting them know the only thing I haven't really done is an echo of their heart. And clinically, I didn't think that that was the issue. And only recently have I had to go, in my mind, backwards to the point now where I'm having to consult neurology earlier. I feel like my disposition times have suffered dramatically because now I'm getting CTs, MRIs, neurology consults, and some of them are still being discharged home for reasons I still don't know because we don't have a clinical decision rule. So have we gone backwards with our use of MRI for TIAs, or do you think that we should be skipping CTs and just going straight to MRIs, or do you think that all TIAs should be admitted? And I've heard all of these bantered about as what our standard of care should be at UMC. What do you guys think?
Well, I think that I agree with you, Chris. There's no evidence for any of the decision rules in it. I shouldn't say rules. It should be instruments. When someone says a rule, it means you're supposed to follow.
Correct.
These are all decision instruments
right.
or tools that we should be using. But the syncope stuff doesn't fall. I mean, then the TIA, none of these have had good decision tools for a long time. And I will sometimes order an MRI trying to expedite the workup so they don't sit in the hospital the whole time because that's, I think, better for the patient, better for the hospital as a whole. You know, what do you, are we going back? It's hard to say. Probably what is the best difference for someone with a TIA? Stopping smoking. That's probably their best difference. Maybe some aspirin, but that's about it. So then the question is, well, if you define the disease, what are you doing? If they truly return to a normal state, you can tell them you had almost like a stroke, right? You couldn't move. That's bad. I think here's some changes you should make. So do you need to admit them all? Maybe they need more follow-up, but I don't know, admitting them, what do we change with those? But I agree. I used to admit all TIAs because they said, oh, it's the continuum of stroke. If you have a
20%
TIA,
of them are going to have a stroke.
They're going to have a stroke, and it's going to be now.
48 hours,
and
then
boom,
within 7 days.
Right. Their head's going to explode. It's bad.
These things are, it's so multifactorial and what the right thing to do is, right? So just take our little world where patients don't have outpatient doctors that they could see expeditiously. They can't get their echo expeditiously. They couldn't go get an MRI in a reasonable amount of time for where you do the ABCD2 score and say, I've got your appointment with your neurologist tomorrow. You're going to get your MRI this afternoon. You can go home, right? So for our patient population, it's probably best to do as many of those things in the hospital as you can. Now, do you need a pre-hospital activation for neurology and all those other? No. Right? As far as I know the literature, those things have improved door to CT times, but not like any patient-related outcome when you do pre-hospital alerts like that. Even if I remember correctly, even for like STEMIs, pre-hospital alerts improve your door to balloon time, but not any of your myocardial performance or outcomes or anything like that.
Those metrics equal dollars.
Exactly. So my point being that if you live in a world like ours, and you're going to do more of these things on an inpatient basis, you need an ED-based observation unit that you can get these people out of the flow of your main ED so that you can do those things and not back up the rest of your ED. I think the places that have been successful in doing this, that's what they do, whether it's for ACS rule-outs or TIA rule-outs and whatnot. Now, one point on the variability that you guys were talking about, I have freely said to you both multiple times that I rely on specifically you two to rein me in because my thought process is biased so much.
No hurt feelings here.
I got hurt feelings. I got hurt feelings.
Somebody can't go see patients and then say, what would Brian or Chris do? they have to say, what do I think as a professional board-certified physician think that this patient needs, and then make the decision whether you want to take that risk or not. And my fear with graphs like this are that people are going to say, oh, what would Brian or Chris do? You know, that's my fear with the variability thing.
So I think that you have, one thing we haven't talked about is considering where you work and even just what your shift is like. Because if I am in a gridlocked ED, because we are on code purple, triage, internal disaster, there's no beds, no one's moving anywhere, guess what? You're going to get an MRI so that I don't have to admit you. Because I know if I admit you, you're just going to sit up here and take another bed for the next 5 days until the inpatient team who is overloaded finally gets to you. If we are wide open and there's not a whole lot of beds going on, you know, nothing happening upstairs, I'm a little more of a sieve as far as, can you please just admit this patient because I've got a lot of people here in the ED I'd like to move through. I happen to know that you've got lots of beds. It's appropriate use of the resources that you have. I don't think we can have an if this, do that kind of mentality with any of the diagnostic studies we do because, yeah, it might be appropriate to admit every single TIA if that's the setting you work in, or it might never be appropriate, or it may be a little bit variable, mm-hmm. you know, depending on what your day is. I tell the residents all the time, I wouldn't normally do this, but looking at our lobby, looking at the kind of day we had, looking at our ED, we're fully staffed, let's do this because I think it's the best care for the patient, and it's something that we can reasonably do. But if I've got an entire ED full of patients that all want MRIs, I can't, I guess, Jared, I got to run over one person instead of the five people. Actually, I guess I'm running over the five people because there's got to be a couple that need it, maybe one, and then a few that I say, look, here's what's in your best interest. And the other thing I want to say is that not everybody wants a diagnosis when they come to the ED. If they come in and you quickly get to their bedside and you get that MRI and it comes back in 15 minutes and the radiologist has read it 5 minutes thereafter and you say, great news, you don't have any of this stuff, they come back and say, I don't care, I still hurt, do something about my pain. They didn't want an MRI. They just wanted to feel better. So if you can rule stuff out without super advanced diagnostic imaging, you can come in and say, we did every test known to man, and they say, I don't give a crap about all of your tests that you did. I feel terrible. You need to do something about the way I feel.
So that's what makes you a professional and not a cop.
Yes. You're not a monkey that's trained to, you know, do X if Y occurs.
Yeah, I guess you could sum up my opinion as, are we having this conversation about MRI because we're ordering too many unnecessarily, the patient didn't need them, it doesn't really improve our diagnostic ability that much, and we're decreasing throughput and increasing costs and whatnot, or are we having this conversation because it's just inconvenient? It's inconvenient to our flow. It's inconvenient to the system and whatnot. But it really is a better test and whatnot. And if it's because of inconvenience, then we need to fix the inconvenience.
I think it's more than that. To me, at least to me, my take is that I think it's inconvenient right now. And I agree, if you fix the inconvenient, that would be great. But I also think it's it's an overtesting, right? You know, we overdiagnose, we overtest, and that is a new push that's been coming on for the last 5 or 10 years in medicine in general. We know we're doing this. We're overdiagnosing things. We're overtreating things. We're causing patient harms. And so when you order more tests, you're going to have more bad outcomes. You don't just have good outcomes when you order tests. And we try to put positive, you know, that's how we think. You look at all of our studies that we do in medicine. Oh, this drug, we always show the positives. We never show the negatives, right? It's always a risk versus a benefit. A risk is a potential harm versus a benefit, which is a true benefit. So it's a potential versus a true, and this is how we formulate everything in medicine. And we're like, oh, well, it shows some benefit. It's a non-inferiority, but everything is better. It's better, but we never talk about the harmful nature of it. So I think when this, it's not like, well, I did the MRI, the patient's harmed. I think it's the incidentaloma that we alluded to. It's the next test. It's the next treatment option. Those are the things that we have to be wary of with this technology, this test, or any other test or technology that comes out in the future. The same thing is going to happen.
Yeah, you are clear. clearly right. I don't want to give the impression that I'm implying one way or the other in my question. It's just, it's a rhetorical question that I am raising.
And I agree. I mean, I think if it's cheaper, faster, and the numbers are better, it makes more sense to do them than a CT to answer the same question. Is the instead of the CT appy, you get in the MR appy. I think that's reasonable. But right now, it's not. In the future, will it be? I hope so. Yeah. But like you said, can you get rid of that inconvenience, and can you get rid of the cost? And as we had talked before, time and money. But that's real. And especially we're going to a value-based care society. Who's going to pay for these MRIs if they're costing, you know, as you were quoting, $250 to $10,000? Who's going to pay for that? They're not going to. Or they're going to say, you get one MRI a year. Best of luck. Who do you want to use it on? And then you're like, well, now I got to really make a decision. Yeah.
So, where are you going to turn that train?
Yeah, it's hard. And these are hard decisions. But this is why we get paid the big bucks. And this is what we're supposed to do as doctors. You make decisions. And in the ER, we have to make decisions. And sometimes it's not doing something. And that's the decision versus doing something. And those are hard. These are very philosophical. Now we're really getting off.
Well, I'm glad we had this conversation, because I think the four of us lie on four very different points of the spectrum.
I'm definitely
in general,
on the spectrum.
Right? I mean, in general, and how we feel about diagnostic uncertainty,
right.
Utilization of studies, you know, utilization of our resources, personal resources,
patient population that we even see between the four of us. It's very different, and I think that we all generally agree that you do what's best for the patient. We have some disagreements about who your patient may be. We have some disagreements about diagnostic uncertainty, but for MRI, I don't think there's any argument that this modality is only going to increase in, at the very least, popularity, if not actual improvements in practice.